Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's International and National Security Law Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, February 8, 2019, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society's telephone conference call. This afternoon's topic is Poland, Renegade or Exemplar? My name is Wesley Hodges, and I'm the Associate Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we're very fortunate to have with us a wonderful panel, and moderating it today is Dr. James J. Carafano, who is Vice President at the Heritage Foundation. After our speakers give their remarks, we'll move to an audience Q&A. Thank you very much for speaking with us today, Jim. The floor is yours to introduce our panel and begin the conversation.
Thank you. So we have two excellent discussants today that bridge both sides of the transatlantic community. So Andrzej Bryk is a law professor in Poland, and Jakub Grygal is an international relations professor in Washington, D.C. in the United States. And actually, I'm going to begin by asking Jakub a question, because while the focus of our discussion here is what is going on in Poland, and how is the debate over judicial reform and transformation, what does that really mean for the state of democracy in Poland? As in many issues that we're dealing with in the transatlantic relationship today, there's a political context in which all these debates are happening. And Jakub served in the U.S. State Department until recently, before he went back into academia full time. And I think it would be interesting to start our discussion by asking you if you could, one, kind of talk about the transition between the previous administration and this administration into how they viewed what's going on in Europe and how that context has been a filter for how we've been analyzing these debates about political debates in countries like Poland and Hungary.
Sure. Thanks, Jim, for the introduction, and I'm happy to participate in this. In many ways, I think the whole debate about the legal and the constitutional issues in Poland is obviously the one that appears on the front pages much more often than anything else. But I think it's dwarfed, or actually it's less important than the change in the attitude towards Poland, and in general, in particular, some group of allies that has been introduced by this administration, the Trump administration, into the foreign policy debate and into the strategy and approach of the U.S. towards Europe. And I think that's driven, it's my sense, over the past 2 years now, by two things, by two factors. One is the realization that we are in a great power competition, and that has been encoded quite clearly in the two key documents of this administration, the National Security Strategy, written by the White House, the National Security Council, and the National Defense Strategy, written by the Department of Defense. And, I mean, one of the key points there is that we're entering, and actually we have been in a great power competition for several years. We have ignored it, and we are kind of catching up with that. And the great power competition is obviously with China, Russia, and in a slightly different way with Iran. And so that realization that we're in a great power competition means that we have to rely on certain allies that actually are at the front line of this great power competition. So there are certain things that happen in Asia, and obviously there are certain things that happen in Europe. So Poland comes into this as one of the key states that is right there at the line separating us, and actually it's part of the competition with Russia. You know, before even we start talking about the law, the constitutional, the tribunal, and the political parties in Poland, that I think is the first building block of our approach, I mean, the American approach towards the region and towards Poland. And, you know, one of the things that the previous administration, the Obama administration, did was, it was a rhetorical little thing, but actually it was quite telling. Namely, they never used, or rarely used, the term allies. They often used the term partners. And partners were both, well, treaty allies, NATO allies, as well as, for instance, China, or in some cases, Russia. If you're an ally and you were called a partner, which is the same term you used, we used for, you know, Russia or China, that kind of probably worried you a little bit. So this is a different administration with a different perspective, and allies are allies, and great power rivals are competitors, rivals, and no longer partners. So again, that's point number one in this changed approach. The second one, somewhat related, but is the somewhat different attitude towards the EU. And usually that's seen as this administration has given up on the EU, it's an enemy of the European Union, and it wants to tear it apart, which I think completely wrong. What I think is different is the realization that the EU is in some form of crisis. We can date it back to 2008 or even before, Brexit being probably the most visible and loud symptom of that. But the problems are much wider than that, right? It's Greece, it's Italy, it's France, it's tensions among the different European countries. Look what happened in the past couple of days between France and Italy. Germany being also a problem for fiscal reasons in the 2008 crisis, for economic reasons, for political reasons, its relationship with Russia, to a certain degree, Iran. So the question that you know, we had was, in the administration in particular, is, well, do we have to automatically always support the EU position and the EU line? The previous administration essentially took the position which was traditional to a certain degree in U.S. foreign policy, was to stand with the EU. And that worked when the EU was not clashing directly with its member states on a variety of issues. When that clash happened under Obama administration, Brexit, the Obama administration took the position that we should support the EU and we should oppose any efforts of Brexit. So Obama goes to England, to the UK, and gives a speech saying essentially that, you know, thou shalt not exit from the EU, and if you exit, you'll get back to, as the way he put it, not in a speech, but in a ad lib, he said, you know, the UK will get to the end of the line, or some version thereof. Well, probably that was the tilting point in the public opinion polls in the UK that tilted that 0.1% towards Brexit. So any intervention that we exercise within the intra-European, intra-EU differences, squabbles, crisis, however you want to call it, it's probably counterproductive. So this administration decided, well, let's just step back a little bit and let the Europeans figure it out. It's their project, and we should not necessarily align ourselves with the EU position versus the national government in question, whatever the national government may be. So in the case of Poland, the position was, well, Poland has some debates about its constitutional court, its laws, its economics, whatever it may be, and the EU, or at least parts of the EU, are strongly opposed to it. Well, we should not necessarily align ourselves with the EU on that division. We don't necessarily have even an opinion on what goes on in Poland, but the opinion is we're going to be neutral to a certain degree between the EU and the country in question. So again, it's not an opposition to the EU, but it's just more of a neutral stance, a neutral position in that internal squabble. So I don't know if that answered your question, Jim.
Understanding all the political context that you just laid out, you know, still in the U.S., there is a lot of interest in the judiciary changes in Poland and what that means for the future of democracy in Poland. There's a lot of discussion here about the decline of democracy in the world. And one of the bellwethers for that, or one of the real measures for that, and is the Freedom House Index. So this year, the Freedom House Index registered a decline in freedom in Poland. And one of the issues that they highlighted was the decline in the independence of the judiciary. The question I want to ask you, both now as an academic and also when you're in the State Department, is that an authoritative measure of whether freedom is actually rising or declining in a country? And, you know, if not, what kind of measures does the U.S. government use, or should we be doing to kind of objectively grade whether we think democracy is advancing or backsliding?
You know, it's a great question, but I have, you know, all the respect for Freedom House and the people that work there and all other organizations that work on these issues. But I'm a little bit skeptical of establishing clearly sort of objective measures of democracy, because fundamentally they're different democracies, and they're not necessarily, there's no one single measure that we can apply equally to all different countries. And I think that is a particular problem in Europe. I think what the assumption was over the past 20 years or so is that a lot of these, particularly Central European countries that joined the EU, they will have to somehow converge into the same legal structure, and including sort of constitutional arrangements that are at least similar to, that all the other previous EU members had. And you know, for the past 15, 20 years, we were on that path to a certain degree. Now, at a certain point, I think there was, I don't know what you call it, a rebellion or rejection of that convergence, of the mandatory convergence, put it that way. And the idea is, look, I mean, they're different nations, and there's a different relationship between, you know, the culture, the nation, including the church, the religious aspects, and politics in country X, say Poland, then country Y, say France. So, you know, the two of them are, you know, slightly different oranges in the democratic family. So saying that democracy has decreased, I think it's a strong statement. I don't have that fear. I think democracy is actually quite vibrant in the country. And if you look at least from here, from the U.S., looking at Poland, look, the mass media is vibrant. There's a lot of criticism of the government. The political parties, well, you can come up with your political party, and I think one or two have been just popped up in the past couple of weeks. There are strong opponents of the government, and, you know, if they win elections, they'll win elections. So, again, I think that is the reliance on quote-unquote objective measures, I think, can be quite risky and dangerous, and because it then influences also our policy towards these countries, and I think is counterproductive.
You know, what I hear you saying is a point that I hear many people echo in this debate about democracy, is that the process measures of did you have an election, the structure of judiciary, don't necessarily get to the fundamental question is are the conditions for human liberty and freedom advancing or declining? So, you know, we have the case in Venezuela today where we have somebody standing up and saying, well, I'm the president because our election wasn't valid. We had the case in Egypt where the Muslim Brotherhood won an election, but then there were widespread, you know, complaints about the Muslim Brotherhood essentially trying to be one election, you know, one time. And we recently had an election in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. It's quite controversial, where the State Department actually came out and said, yes, this is a mark of progress in advance because we've had an election here, and many other governments actually rejected the election as legitimate, and there are different agencies in the U.S. government that there is this kind of real debate that we have in the democracy community about using these kind of clear process measures as objective measures. And that's where I think your previous point about context matters, or the filter through which we're hearing about these debates and understanding how that may change our perception of the facts and what's going on. Then there's also the methodological question about whether we're actually measuring things that are actually measuring freedom or not, which really gets us to the point of where I think Professor Brick could be really helpful here, because the fundamentals of what are the actual changes doing in terms of impacts on the judiciary system are really important. So let me just ask you, are these the kind of, within the debate, within the State Department, how do they kind of deal with these kinds of issues and debates? And, you know, particularly when we've seen a lot of controversy over not just Poland, but also Hungary, and really arguments made on very technical questions about management of the judiciary, specific laws that impact NGOs, specific laws that impact media. So how do they adjudicate these things?
Like most things in politics, they're adjudicated through a political process. That's why the role of political appointees is key. But I think without going into the details of the internal debates in the State Department, the reliance on process is risky because, to give an example, somehow, as I understand it, we and for the past several years were pushing the idea that essentially, Supreme Court justices ought not to be appointed by the executive in countries, including in Poland, that there was no role for the executive in appointing essentially the Supreme Court justices. And the idea, their justification was like, well, most European, the EU does not want that. That's not part of the procedures of the EU. Well, again, I mean, we do that. So why is it that we're pushing abroad a process that we ourselves don't espouse? The president appoints a Supreme Court justice, obviously, and the Senate has to approve it, which is the same process, I think, a similar process in Poland. The president appoints and has to go through an approval in the parliament. So there, you know, you start picking sides in procedural issues, which is quite dangerous because, well, which one is better? And I'm not sure, you know, one is better than the other one. There's a set of traditions. There are certain constitutional issues. There are sort of historical reasons for that particular process that works better for one country and not for another, right? We're not going to have, hopefully, we're not going to change the Constitution and have Supreme Court justices being nominated and approved by Congress, right? I don't know. Maybe at some point in our life, but I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon. Well, you know, why should we're not changing that? Why should we force other countries, which are democratic countries, to alter their own traditional procedures? That's one issue. The second issue, I think, is a lot of these debates, political, even procedural in those countries, including in Poland, really revolve around a conflict which is not just legal, but it's a cultural conflict. To give you an example, the question of human rights. And human rights, the number of human rights have expanded. I'm not an expert in this, but they've expanded exponentially over the past decades. And to such a degree that we no longer, in some of our statements, for instance, recognize the Universal Declaration of Human Rights as the primary document because it's antiquated. Well, you know, in some countries, including more conservative countries, the list of human rights is not as long. It does not include the right to abortion, the right for gay marriage. It doesn't include a right for, you name it, all the social and cultural war rights in many ways. And so the procedural debates then get tinted by a particular definition of human rights. And throughout most of the, you know, federal bureaucracy, I think, in the State Department, for a variety of reasons, you know, there's a much more progressive interpretation of human rights. And we try to, you know, at least the bureaucracy is on a path of pushing that as a measure also of liberty. So if you don't recognize, for instance, gay marriage, that's a violation of human rights, as opposed to being, you know, the will of the people based on a certain tradition, on a certain interpretation of marriage, and a certain understanding of the role of men and women. You know, we can go into sort of details of this, but so it's the procedural issue. Therefore, there is used almost as a hammer to push a particular ideological interpretation of a particular substantive issue, which again, from a foreign policy perspective, has its own issues. But from a even analytical perspective, I think it's mistaken because it's assumed that every country will accept it. And also assume that there's no debate within the U.S. even on these issues. And we are shocked when there's a debate in, say, in the case of Poland on these issues. Like, how could they have a debate, you know? Well, we have them, too, in this country, and we certainly, you know, we don't agree on all of these issues, and that's part of the reason we have particular elections. That's part of the reason we have such a fight about Supreme Court. So, it's not just a procedural debate, if that's what you're asking.
But this gives me a chance to ask Jakob another question. And then after that question, if there are, you know, questions, Jakob will be happy to field them. Let me ask you from your research that you're doing now, but also from your time at State, is how much of this is a power struggle between Berlin and Paris and Brussels and Warsaw and Budapest? How much of this is a part of the natural process of European integration, of just attempting to harmonize systems and laws? And how much of this of these various issues do you think are legitimate concerns about the backsliding of democracy in Central Europe?
Well, it's a big set of questions. Starting from the last one, again, I'm a little bit reluctant to jump on the backsliding bandwagon, if you want to put it that way. I don't see, especially in Poland, in the Czech Republic or Slovak Republic, serious issues with that. Not that I agree with every political stance of this or that government, and there are certain plenty of issues that we can take. But backsliding is a little bit dangerous to argue, because I think it also assumes that there's a progressive line that you have to enter, a progressive path that you have to enter in order to be considered a democracy. So in the moment you say no to some key ideologically charged issues, you're deemed to be backsliding. And that's what I think it's really dangerous. I mean, you know, people argue, including Freedom House, that the U.S. is backsliding in democracy because of the Trump administration. I think that's an exaggeration. It's not true. So, again, I think it's a risky term. Now, how much all of this is part of a larger process of integration in the EU, and how much is the power struggle? Again, big question, and, you know, this would require probably whole new lecture on this. But quickly, I think two points. One is, I think the process of integration of the EU has reached a stalemate at best. It's not happening. It's not happening in terms of geography. I think enlargement has stalled pretty much, and it's not going to move forward especially eastward, and I think that is related in particular to the 2014 war in Ukraine. So that's the enlargement is stalled. And integration within, I think that's a big debate. I think there are forces that insist on further and further integration, including now fiscal policies. I mean, there's most of it, it's monetary policy, the euro, and fiscal policy was never integrated. So now the next step obviously naturally should have been fiscal policy, but, you know, a lot of political parties within most of these countries are opposed to it. In the moment you have fiscal integration, national parliaments have no meaning because they no longer set the budget. One of those fights actually had nothing to do with Poland. It was about Italy, where the national parliament voted a budget that violated the percentage of the deficit of the GDP. And, you know, they got reprimanded and forced to alter the budget by the EU. Well, you know, that creates tensions within those countries and between the countries and EU authorities. So integration, further integration, I think is very, very risky and dangerous. That is why I think throughout most of the European countries, you have political parties or rather political movements that are broadly called Eurosceptical, but that's, again, a term that defines everything and kind of muddles the profound differences among them. But they are not necessarily anti-EU. This is not UKIP that wants to leave the EU everywhere. It's more that, you know, political parties have said the EU should not dictate, for instance, national laws. The EU Commission should not dictate what the budget is, and so on and so forth. So there is, you know, in many ways, the power struggle is first and foremost between the forces that insist the EU has to continue on a path of further and further integration and the forces within the different countries that say, no, there should be a pause, or at least maybe not even a regression, but at least a pause or stop for this. In Poland, given that's the subject of the discussion, very few people are for exiting the EU. The EU has been seen as an enormous success. It's a historic success of the century, if not more, actually, probably the past three centuries. Poland is, you know, in Europe again, and then the EU being an expression of it. So even the most conservative, and including, you know, EU skeptic parties, don't advocate the withdrawal from the EU. They're all for it. They're happy to be in it. And they just wanted the EU to be slightly less assertive and aggressive for in terms of its process of integration. Last point, power struggle. Well, you know, balance of power never, I think we kind of lived in a decade or two decades thinking the balance of power in Europe has been transcended. It's all postmodern. We're entering this great harmonious era of European happiness and joy, et cetera, et cetera. Balance of power is always there. And it was muted to a certain degree, but it was present. It started to perk up, if you want, for two separate reasons and related. One had to do with the financial crisis, so starting from 2008, when it became evident that really Germany is truly the dominant economic power and can dictate in many ways the fiscal and monetary and economic decisions of particular countries. In this particular case, we're talking about the Mediterranean countries and in particular Greece. that created resentment. That visible, tangible, daily intervention in the Greek economy created resentment, not just in Greece, but across the southern European countries, Italy and Spain in particular. So that's one. The second cause of this balance of power coming back up is the set of threats that have visibly created tension within Europe, the set of threats from outside. So Russia being one, 2008 invasion of Georgia, 2014 war in Ukraine, and continued aggressive behavior. Two is Syria and the related migration crisis. And three, it's the ongoing but sort of more and more explosive, again, migration problem coming from North Africa and the sub-Saharan Africa. And the nature of this threat is obvious, that of these threats is that some countries are more threatened than others. Italy feels more threatened by the migration crisis coming from Libya, North Africa, and the sub-Saharan Africa. The Balkan countries felt more threatened by the Syrian migration crisis, and the Central Europeans and Baltics have felt, rightly so, more threatened by Russia. Well, you know, how do you adjudicate this fundamentally different threat assessment? The EU was completely incapable, as such, to give an answer. So what you had is, and it's ongoing, is intra-European debates, some of them more vicious than others, about how to address these threats, what are the priorities, and which threats should be addressed first, and how much, in what way, and related to that, what is the role of the U.S. in this? And obviously, you know, if you're seeing a threat of Russia, say in Poland, you want to build Fort Trump, as they ask for it, in the U.S. with American troops. If you're in Italy, you really don't care about Fort Trump. You don't care about the U.S. You just want to fix Libya. And that creates tensions on a daily basis with France. So it's the geopolitical environment around Europe has been peaceful for the past decades until the middle, you know, the 2005, 2006, 2008 period. And therefore, over the past decade, that unstable and threatening geopolitical environment has created pressures within Europe that are creating, you know, a lot of tensions and increasingly more acrimonious diplomatic relations within Europe. So, again, it's a power struggle driven by inability of the EU to adjudicate these differences and by the threatening geopolitical environment.
Thank you for sharing that context, and we'll open it up here to see if there are any questions. So listening to your thoughts, though, I mean, the one thing that prompts me is, we have this kind of fixation on political liberties, and I wonder if in some respects that is blinding us to, you know, other threats to democracy, which might be even more significant. And I think particularly in terms of economic freedom, which is, ironically, I think, much more easily quantifiable than political freedoms in some case. But where we do see real clear threats that could undermine democracy. So on the one hand, I point to kind of classic crony capitalism, which is kind of a leftover from the old, you know, managed economy days of the Warsaw Pact era and the influence of oligarchs in places like Ukraine and maybe crony capitalism in Hungary and other countries where you might point to, or Serbia, where you might point to, that these are just not just an economic drag, but they're a drag on freedom, which is, I think, an issue that countries struggle with. And on the other hand, which we increasingly hear a lot from Europeans, is the threat to democracy is not judicial issues in Poland, but the increasing influence of not just Russian disinformation and active measures, but Chinese money and influence. And I like to, for folks that care about these issues, I like to point to two reports. One is called Corrosive Capitalism, which is done by the Center for International Private Enterprise, which looks at how China and Russia use economic tools in ways that could affect and undermine democracy and political institutions. And then there's also an excellent report from the National Endowment for the Democracies called Sharp Power that looks at media manipulation's other instruments. So if you were saying, well, where are the real threats to democracy and freedom in Western Europe, if it's not more in those categories, than it is in these issues. And I regret that we didn't have Professor Brook here to really kind of unpack for us the specifics of the judicial maneuvering in Poland. So let me thank Jakub, and then Wes, are there any questions on the line?
Jim, it does look like we do have one question from the audience so far. Should we go with that caller?
Great, thank you.
Wonderful. Caller, you are up.
I'm curious to know, as far as the Polish people, what is their perception of the success rate or lack thereof of some of the other Western European countries as they have attempted to require assimilation of some of these immigrants from Africa or Syria? And for those pockets that have become fairly insulated from Western culture and are insisting not only on keeping their former ways, which in these cases are anti-democratic, and also trying to impose those on the culture around them. Are the Polish people understanding the difficulties that some other countries, Sweden and Austria, for example, are admitting that they're having?
I think it's a great question, and it's obviously politically lively question, because it has created and continues to create an enormous debate within Europe, and including criticism of countries like Poland and Hungary, which have rejected the mandatory quotas on accepting migrants. So a couple of things. One is, yes, I think the experience over the past several decades of some of these countries, the Nordic countries, Germany, Austria, but frankly, you know, I think Belgium and France, being probably the ones that are on the front pages most often, have definitely created certain skepticism about the possibility of, and or at least the difficulty of assimilation. So that's one. Two, Poland and in general Central Europe and the Baltic countries too, well, don't have a tradition of accepting people that are so fundamentally different culturally. In Western Europe, in some Western European countries, say France, Italy, Great Britain, you have, for instance, a colonial tradition, and for a variety of reasons, you had people of different culture, different religion, different ethnicity that have been within that polity for decades, if not even longer. And most Central Europeans, well, never had colonies outside of the European continent. They have colonies, period. And so that, there's, again, no tradition of this. Third point, Poland in particular has taken a lot of migrants and refugees from Ukraine, starting, and particularly over the past 4 years, 5 years now, since 2014, when the Russians took over Crimea and invaded eastern Ukraine. The numbers fluctuate, but it's about 1 million, which is a lot. Most of these people came just to try to escape the poverty and the war zone of eastern Ukraine. And so, you know, they're working, they're employed, most of them, but they're visible, they're present. And you know, the Polish government says, well, they should be counted as also migrants that we are taking because of the proximity with Ukraine. You know, Italy has a different problem with migrants from a different region. Poland has been taking Ukrainians. Fourth point and last point, and that goes to a bigger question and a bigger many ways answer. There's a very strong sense of national unity and the need to preserve the nation, which is a cultural entity defined by a common history and a shared religion. It has deep roots in Poland, because as a nation, the understanding is, as a nation, you can survive and maintain some modicum of liberty even if you lack a political state. So that was a particular tradition for 100 plus years since the partitions of Poland at the end of the 18th century until the end of World War I. Poland as a state did not exist, but the idea was Poland as a nation did. And that's what maintained the possibility of freedom. And as a matter of fact, even without a Polish state, you could still be free because you maintained a certain sense of who you were, of what were your principles, what were your beliefs. So that obviously continued actually after World War II under the Soviet and communist domination, where the nation as such, again, understood as a cultural entity with a shared religion, maintained freedom. You know, during the communist years, you could be free in many ways if you went to a church and you could speak on a variety of issues, even that were not fully within the Catholic tradition, but you could still be free in that. That was a sort of a space of freedom that you could carve out in absence of political reality. That idea of that strong idea of a nation, for a variety of reasons, I think has been lost and is not as present, I think, in Western Europe or in the Nordic countries. Has to do with the history, World War II for Germany, World War I for France and Italy. And so that, you know, that sense of the need and necessity of maintaining that cohesiveness and that unity within the nation, I think is very much a driving force behind certain political decisions.
I think those are all excellent points. Let me add to just a few of those. And I particularly like your point about it's incorrect to paint many European countries as anti-refugee, because many of them have many refugees. They just happen to be not from the Middle East. So in Switzerland, for example, there's a reason why the star of the Swiss soccer team is a Kosovar. That's because there's a large Kosovar population in Switzerland, and indeed from the Balkans wars, there's people spread out all over Europe, and as you mentioned, Ukraine and also Georgia, and many of these countries have been very welcoming and very supportive of their refugee population. So just painting them as anti-refugees probably not fair. I think another important issue for many of the Central European countries is fiscal burden. I mean, Poland's economy is relatively strong, but many of these countries have very slow growth, and the notion of taking on an enormous additional social burden of populations that don't speak the language and aren't readily employable and aren't immediately going to add to the GDP and the productivity, that's daunting for especially a smaller country with a slow growth GDP as compared to, say, a Germany or some of the Nordic countries. Many of these countries also have had some pretty significant population decline. One of the, again, not so much, well, Poland went through this, but other countries even more severely. The first thing that happened when they joined the European Union is many of the young people left for parts of Europe where economic growth were higher. And so they've had significant population decline. And I think the notion of large, immigrant foreign populations would significantly impact on their own country. So it's not like the United States, where you have a population of 320 million people, and if 100,000 people come in, you've got 320 million and 100,000 people. But if your population has shrunk from, say, 6 million to 4 million, and you're adding significant new numbers, that's an issue. And then, the other thing, which doesn't get a lot of discussion at all, is particularly for many of the refugees and migrants that have come from the Middle East or North Africa, these are not the countries they want to go to. And, regardless of the EU plan to kind of spread them across Western Europe, the reality is once they're in Western Europe, they can go wherever they want. And many of them immediately would leave, even the ones that went to these countries, whether it was the Baltic states or some of the Central European countries, many of them just left and they went to where they wanted to go to, which in many cases was Germany or France or Belgium or the Nordic countries. And I think, that too often we take a very complex environment, which is Western Europe, and we overly simplify how these things lay out. And I think certainly how Europeans feel about refugee and immigration issues is one of them. How they fear about populist parties is another one. What is populism in Hungary isn't the same as what's populism in the UK. UKIP is not Fidesz. And, it's if you don't really dig into the diversity of the European experience and you kind of mirror image it from what we think we're experiencing in the U.S. or overly simplify it, you don't really understand the internal challenges and stresses that the Europeans are going through today. So, Wes, are there other questions on the line?
The queue is empty. If anyone would like to ask a question before we wrap up today, and thank you so much, caller, for your question. Feel free to ask another if you'd like. Seeing no immediate bites, Jim, I turn the mic back to you for however else you'd like to direct the conversation.
Well, I'd like to thank the Federalist Society for organizing the toast. I'd like to thank Jakob. I'd actually love to come back and dig into this some more. And so thanks for having us. It was a super productive and useful discussion. So thank you guys.
Same here. Thank you. Thank you all for organizing it. Thank you, Jim, for running this.
Well, Jim and Jakob, we are very appreciative of your time. Everyone, I'd like to thank them on behalf of the Federalist Society. We want to thank our experts for the benefit of the valuable time and expertise today. We welcome all listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining. This call is now adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.